Yesterday we talked about image news and image policies, especially a slice of history when the modern Middle East was created, a slice of 7 years from 1915 to 1922, when the Western powers, Britain, France, and Russia, especially Britain, took it upon themselves to draw lines on the map and put people in thrones and give names to countries and even design flags for countries and say, this is the modern Middle East, this is what will replace the Ottoman Empire. And the question that the historians ask is, will the local people ever accept this arrangement, which is now 70 years old and still coming apart at the seams? The question I posed as part of this series was, how do we break the cycle of our misperception and misbehavior with the region? How do we break that cycle? Today's session is called Fundamentalism versus Faith. And the question I'd like to put to you is this. Is it what they are or what we choose to see in them? When we speak about the Middle East and about the people over there that we have so much trouble with, is it what they are or what we choose to see in them? Keep that one in your minds as we talk.
That what has been fed to us, we may not choose to see it as, but you know, turn on an Indiana Jones movie and everybody is waving a sword, slashing somebody, and I didn't choose to see that.
Right.
And it's not what they are.
Well, you do choose to see it if you buy the ticket. That's one small thing, you know. That speaks.
Well,
if we want to get off into that.
In a way, I don't know if I'm going to get truth or image.
But I'm using, all the way through this, I'm using the word we in a collective sense, and I'm just tarring the whole country with the same brush, because over there, that's the way it sort of looks, although they know that Americans might be different from their government. We use the word we as a sort of a warning to ourselves that we act as one nation in that part of the world. And quite often it isn't, we're more part of the problem than we are part of the solution. Somebody asked yesterday how we could solve it. Today what I'd like to do is weave together two strands. The first one is consequences of the bad images that we have. Okay? The consequences of having that much negative imagery about a part of the world. And in case you think I get carried away with negative imagery, I'm working in media. I didn't say where I work for those of you who haven't been here before. I work in media. So that's my approach. And of course, everybody thinks where they work is the bee's knees or your discipline. But there's a lot of relationship between imagery and media and perception and the troubles we're talking about. The troubles themselves are, of course, much more important and much more substantial than any one particular discipline's insight to that area. I'd like to weave the consequences of the negative imagery together with fundamentalism and its, in parentheses, versus faith. But we'll stick with that word for the moment. You can have the versus faith as your sort of background idea. And so we go down the list of one and we sort of look for the thread of the other as we talk about our perception of the Middle East. When I'm done with this, I'd like you to meet two fundamentalists, two Muslim fundamentalists in this case, through the medium of video that we have up there. Now, the first consequence that I'd like to mention of that negative imagery is what we can call demonization. What I mean by that is that we sort of let this negative imagery build up like sludge in your heart valves or something, and after a while you're only looking through a little tiny hole and all you see is demons out there. Just imagine for a second, what country in the world do we like the most? I'm going to go in the other direction for a second and then come back to the Middle East. What's our favorite country as Americans? Apart from ourselves. Overseas. England.
Europe.
Australia's been popular for a while, hasn't it? We all sort of like Australia. Holland. Norway. Norway's a good one. Scandinavia. They got oil. They got oil. Let's think about Norway. Could we ever have carried out a war like the Gulf War against Norway? Would we have stood for the kind of coverage we got, for the kind of censorship we put up with, for the kind of, you know, block between reality and what we were doing out there, turning it into a kind of a movie show, War in the Desert, Desert Storm, all this kind of hype that went on about it. Would we ever villainize, what's her name, the Prime Minister of Norway right now?
Brundtland.
Brundtland, yeah, Brundtland. We don't even know who she is, let alone villainize her, you know? But would we ever do what to her what we do to Saddam Hussein, or to Muammar Gaddafi, or to Ayatollah Khomeini, or to Yasser Arafat, who is the leader of another group of people? Would we ever allow, stand for, that kind of villainization of a good Norwegian prime minister? I mean, good or bad, of any Norwegian as a prime minister, or any Britisher as a prime minister, any Australian, some of the places that we know like that. Would we have stood for such a sanitized war against a country like Holland? We know that the Dutch are nice people. Anybody who's been there knows that they're real friendly, hospitable. And anybody who's been to Iraq or Libya would probably say they're friendly, hospitable people. So what's the difference?
Well, the media could still, I mean, it would be much more difficult, but the same techniques could still be used.
They'd have a go?
We did it with Hitler and Germany.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Right?
It's not as easy to pull off, that's
right.
For sure.
I think it took us a while, though. Yeah. Perhaps we didn't recognize Hitler for what he was because we didn't have this seedbed of negativism that we could call on like we did. So it's maybe worked in the other way around, and we finally got all worked up and figured out. But how much did we tar the German people with that brush? And when we talk about it, we talk about Hitler and the Nazis. We don't talk about the Germans, or we try not to, because I'm half German. How many here are part German, you know? Look at that, you know. So we have a link. How many here are part Iraqi, you know, or part Libyan, or part Palestinian? Most of us aren't. There's only a few Arab Americans in this country. So demonization is one thing to think about. Second thing is really here, and we start to weave, but we can put fundamentalism as a subset of consequences. When you have a lot of negative images, what you do is you give comfort to fundamentalists. And you use their material without criticizing it. You find yourself using stuff you would never generate yourself, but you sort of buy into things that you wouldn't put out. And let's be clear what we mean. Yes?
I'm not sure what you mean by fundamentalism.
What we mean by fundamentalism. I just looked in the dictionary, and the Random House Dictionary says this: strict adherence to any set of basic ideas or principles, which probably, you know, covers a lot of different things, but let's focus in a bit more. And I think from a religious point of view, we can focus in on people who have a certain mindset, who tend to see things in black and white. And I'm sorry for that imagery. I don't have a better way to say it. Maybe we should go the other way and say that the skin colors don't fit with the imagery. But let's talk about black and white. People who see things like that, they don't have any room for gray. They sort it all out into good and bad. And see the world in that way. They think of monolithic
you're saying,
enemies.
You're saying that the people of the Middle East are fundamentalists?
That's what I hope we won't say at the end of the hour. But that's what I think a lot of us sort of let sit in our minds without examining it very closely. How many times are two words used together, Muslim and fundamentalist? How many times, it's like those two girls got married. You know, who married them? Islamic fundamentalists. And we believe it almost by virtue of repetition. It falls off our tongue. And when you're a journalist, it falls out of your pen or out of your camera because you got to write fast. So you use words that people understand. Muslim fundamentalists. We all know what that is, don't we? So it's that part of it that I'm most interested in. But going back to something which is beyond the field of journalism, is really this religious question, or this sort of psycho worldview question of blacks and whites, you know, not having much room for ambiguities, wanting to sort all things out and say those are the enemy and we're the good guys and we're going to get them, or this is right and that's wrong, and we don't have any time for the people who are with that wrong thing, where principles rise up above people, you know, where holiness rises up above love, your sense of your own holiness. All those things, I think, is what this kind of fundamentalism term means. Other questions about that? Can we proceed with some kind of consensus, what we're talking about when we say fundamentalism? And you'll find out that it's meant, we mean it as something, the opposite of faith, and something that is there and here. not just over there, and not perhaps even over there any greater than anywhere else.
Would it be Ayatollah Khomeini's fundamentalism? Are you going to tie it in with that or not?
Well, that would be a separate session, but I sort of thought that we're pretty safe. When I went there, I sort of thought we're pretty safe calling him one. But then I met my landlord's son, who spoke of him as I would speak about the prophet Isaiah. And I tended to believe this guy for some other reasons, and it just stopped me cold. So let's not put him in the pot yet, okay? Let's keep him out. Much as we don't even question him, we think he's the craziest man, was the craziest man for the decade, last decade. But, I wouldn't necessarily buy it. But let's see what you think in a little while. These things that fundamentalists use become a stock in trade for them, and we partake of them on both sides, on Muslim and Christian history. And let me keep it there in this domain of us and what is fundamentalist in each one of us. What is the fundamentalist in each one of us? From the Lutheran, I pulled out a few items here that are interesting. A guy named Harold Vogelaar, who was a missionary like myself. I work for the Middle East Council of Churches in the Middle East, part of the ELCA. This guy worked for the ELCA in Egypt. And he said, Christianity and Christians, we think that we stand for peace, for love, for integrity, for justice, for freedom, for openness. The first day in the class here, one man said he was a World War II veteran, not a World War I veteran, a World War II veteran, and he said that we go over there and fight for the right. We went over there and cleaned up things in World War II, and the inference was that that's when we go to war, we do that. And I think that was the inference that George Bush hoped we would make in the Gulf War. So he's playing on this self-image that we are peace, love, integrity, justice, and all those kinds of things. Freedom, openness, all those things. And for us, Islam and Muslims, and the two things get branded together real quickly, the religion and the people, they stand for war, for deception, for violence, for intolerance, partiality, oppression, for closedness, the opposite of openness. In almost every instant, the opposite of what we are. We're peace, they're war. We're love, they're deception. We're justice, they're violence. You know? So this ought to, you know, set off some warning lights in us, because the world can't be this simple. But we sort of live with that kind of outlook. And then if you go over on the other side and ask Muslims what they think of Christians, and we're not talking fundamentalists now, we're talking of average Muslims like you and I are average Christians, and they say, well, Christians are much more divided than we were. Look at them. And in fact, in Tuesday's session, we mentioned that there were 10,000 denominations of Christianity. They said they're much more divided than we are. They're more racist. They're less tolerant. Now, why would they say that? Probably because they know that we don't like them. So they say we're racist. So they say that we're intolerant. Because they know we don't like them. That's how it looks from their side. They say that we're less disciplined and less God-fearing. And there you don't have to say too much in return, I think. One of the people you'll meet on the tape says it very strongly, that point. So, fundamentalism and fundamentalists, giving them comfort, aiding them, being bedfellows with them, is a consequence of negative imagery. When we let this kind of imagery, that we're good and they're bad, when we let that sort of froth away in our brains without even knowing it, and then act on that basis, we are living out some of the consequences of our negative imagery, I think. That's another thing I want to put up here as a consequence is that we settle for fabrications. We confuse or accept fabrications as reality or as truth. The real story does not get told, and we don't even notice. In fact, we think it's the real story, so it is getting told, but it isn't. It's a fabrication. We settle for it. Some examples of this. We mentioned that in an earlier session that the Holy Land as a concept, we think that's the real story. It's a place where Jesus walked. It's a place to go and get your faith sort of shined up by being close to the facts where it all happened. But that is a place where only that happened, where we go looking for Jesus' footprints. But the real story, if you want to talk about Jesus and his message and what he did among us, is to look for the footprints of his disciples today. Look for his footprints, but then ask who's following him. Is anybody still following him on the spot? What are they like? Look for the living stones. Don't look for the dead stones. Look for the real story being that mixture of things that is so much like our struggle as Christian people, as faithful people, which happens in that part of the world today as it did in Jesus' time. Don't think of it as a Holy Land, as a Bible museum. Don't settle for that fabrication. The Holy Land as a term and as a concept and as something that you pay good money for in a travel agency, that is a fabrication. And tourism is a lot more fun if you go and see the real place instead of the travel fabrication for yourself. Another example that comes to me from being over there with this question of fabrications and the consequences of the imagery is the whole question of Jerusalem. Now, Jerusalem is everybody's fabrication, or everybody who's concerned about it. They turn it into their own fabrication. It started a long time ago. Apparently, the Eastern Christians spoke mostly about the holy sites, the holy places within Jerusalem. They didn't say all that much about the city. The Crusaders started this business about the holy city and the Holy Land. And it was a peculiar thing for them to do because they were spending most of their time over there, you know, raping and pillaging. So, but it was still the Holy Land after they got done with it, I guess. It's changed hands a lot after the Crusaders. The Muslims had it in various under various headings, Salah ad-Din, the Mamluks, the Ottomans, the Turks, the British, and now the Israelis control it. The Jordanians after the British, and then the Israelis. And if you go there and look hard enough, you can find how each group tells their story of Jerusalem, and the most dramatic example of it, and it becomes a fabrication when it's taken too far, is the museum in the Tower of David at the Jaffa Gate. Has anybody been through it? Yeah. Go there and go through it. It's a wonderful museum. But what it does is it establishes the Jewish claim to Jerusalem and its history from the point of view of the Jews and what Jerusalem means to them, and the other periods, which are longer actually than the Jewish periods, sort of fall out through the cracks. And it ends up with Jerusalem as the eternal capital of Israel. They declared it the eternal capital, indivisible. They won't negotiate about it. If this peace process ever gets to Jerusalem, it is going to stop and not move again, because Jerusalem is the eternal capital. And it doesn't take much to throw a little bit of sand in the face of that argument. You've got in the world three monotheistic religions, and Jerusalem is important for all of them. And if we just talk some facts, there are a billion Christians, roughly. And Jerusalem, for us, is number one, right, as a holy place in the world. I mean, you go there, the stuff just jumps out at you, even from the stones, if that's all you're looking at. That's why people keep going there, even if you don't get to the living stones. So there's a million Christians for whom it's number one as a place on earth, the holy city, let alone all the thinking about the new Jerusalem and all that stuff. There are how many Jewish people in the world? I think 12 or 13 or 14 million if we add up the ones in Israel, the ones in the Soviet Union, the ones here, South Africa, France, Australia, Canada. Let's say 50.
A million Christians?
A billion.
Okay.
A billion Christians in the world. You thought we took a loss overnight?
It's a whole order of magnitude job.
Yeah. So 15 million. I shouldn't put it there, should I? It looks like it's the same. There's 15 million. Roughly Jewish people in the world, for whom it's also number one in a bigger way than it is for us, because their history was worked out there in a way that Christian history hasn't been. It's been going other places since then. And then there's about a billion, Muslims, for whom it's number three. Mecca is number one, Medina is number two, and Jerusalem's number three. It's the place from which Muhammad took his journey up to heaven and was returned to earth. That's where the Dome of the Rock is. And they also recognize that the Dome of the Rock is where Abraham tried to sacrifice Isaac, and where Jesus, the great prophet, was crucified. And yesterday, I think I said Jesus was, they didn't want him crucified because he was God's son. That's wrong. They don't think of him as God's son. They think of him as a great prophet whom God would never let get crucified. So they don't have that. They don't read the Bible to say that Jesus got crucified. It was an imposter. He got taken away. He'll come back at the judgment day, is what the Muslims say, reading from the Bible, which they honor. So For the three monotheistic, and if we want to be a little patting on ourselves on the back, the three finest faiths in the world, Abrahamic faiths, they all go back to Abraham. It's number 1, number 1, and number 3. For these places. So how come these guys get to call it their eternal capital? Or how come we would go so far as to make that a real possibility by our actions in the last 20 or 30 years? It's something that needs to be looked at in a little bit more light of reality, a little bit light, less light, of one person's version or one particular version of what's going on. Another real story that doesn't get told. It gets told a bit more than it was before, but I think of the peace process, the peace talks, which are sort of hopefully starting up again here in a few days, maybe even this week, between the Israelis and the Palestinians. What's the real story there? Is it that we've got one democracy, one peace-loving country that is finally trying to make peace with all of its angry, belligerent, hostile, terrorist neighbors? And that it would be good if they did that, we all agree. One of the Palestinian negotiators said, our peace negotiations are like this. There's a glass of water on a table and two men negotiating over that glass of water. And as they negotiate, one of the men keeps sipping from the glass of water. And after a little while, depending how fast you sip, there isn't anything left to negotiate about. Now that is an opening onto the real story of the peace process. You've got a people who are like the half glass of water, and it's going down. They're leaving, they're being forced to leave, their land is being taken from them. If you go to the West Bank, it's like a slow motion war where bulldozers and cranes are the artillery and the tanks of that war. And you have to say this without implying that the Jewish people don't have a right to be there. They're there, we can't do anything about it, even if some people would like to. But they've got to be there recognizing, like we said yesterday, that the original inhabitants have a claim on the place too. And a very imperfect solution for that is to settle for the 1967 borders and to create a state of Palestine in the occupied territories in the Gaza Strip. That's reality. This business about Israel all the way to Jordan River or beyond, that is fabrication. That is putting principles above the people who are there on the ground, whose lives will be ended if you don't be a little bit more related to reality. This is about real stories not being told, and a very similar type of thing is that real questions, when you live with bad imagery, real questions don't get asked. The real questions, should I say, they don't get asked. There's plenty of examples in this. When you're talking about the Middle East, you can change your examples every week and sort of prove the point. I'm stuck at about 4 weeks ago because on the plane on the way over here I read Newsweek, and there was a cover story about the Iranian airliner in 1988 that was shot down by a U.S. Guided missile cruiser, the Vincennes. Some of you remember the incident? 290 Iranians on an Airbus,
yes,
shot out of the sky in 1988 by one of our marvelous weapons. And this Newsweek article a month ago, they did a lot of work, I guess, and they decided that there was another story that hadn't been told and plenty of questions that hadn't been asked. And don't want to get into it too much. I'd encourage you to go look for that back issue of Newsweek. It's about the second week in July. But in a word, one of our billion-dollar robo-cruisers, as they called it, mistook an Airbus climbing at airliner speed at 8,000 feet for an F-14 diving at 4,000 feet in attack mode. They flicked all the switches onto enemy aircraft, unidentified, aggressive intentions, whatever the lingo they have. And the captain was more, at the moment, more worried about some Iranian Revolutionary Guard speedboats who were up in the water in front of him. He was in Iranian waters when he did all this. He was going after those speedboats like gnats with his big cruiser, trying to shoot them up. And then one of his crew on the fire control unit and the big computer that they couldn't even run properly kept telling him about this blimp that was coming in, and when he finally paid attention to it, he said, go ahead, take it out. And it was an airliner. And they have a picture of some of the bodies floating in the water on the first page of the article. Now this, you know, we sort of settled for it. Why? Because it was the Iranians. They're the people who took us hostage for 444 days. They're the people who go through the streets and wave their fists and swords and say death to America and call us the great Satan. The Pentagon's explanation for the disaster was not to say, we made a mistake, it's a terrible mistake, let's try to set it right. It was to say, they lied about the position of the ship, they took an Iranian island off the map when they did the briefing for the press, so that the Iranian coastal waters would be small enough to let the cruiser be where it was without being in territorial waters. And they gave medals to all the captain and several of the crew who were running the thing at the time to emphasize their, you know, their manhood under fire. I'm sure we weren't happy about it. Most of us were bothered by the fact that 290 people lost their lives. But nobody called it a mistake or a tragedy, virtually, at the official level. They tried to whitewash it. And I think they could only do that because Ayatollah Khomeini was the president or the leader of Iran at that time, not the president. And Iran is a nation of crazies. Look what they've done to us. I'm sorry we did this to them, but they deserve it. You know, that kind of mentality carries the day. And the real questions about that, how it happened, what's the real story, didn't get asked. Let me mention a couple things which are alternatives, stories of the Middle East that never get addressed very fully.
The thing I was going to say is that there are some people who do ask those real questions.
That's true.
And with intense frustration.
Absolutely.
But the surprising thing to me is that there's so many people that even when they see the real answers in front of them, don't hear them or listen to them. Mm-hmm. That there does seem to be a kind of almost deafness in our society to hearing that our country did something really very manipulative, even to us. That sense that nobody asks the question, there is a few that are continually asking, how can this happen?
Question up here.
Yeah. Are you in the light fixture up there?
Yeah, I'm right here in the light. I was, as you told the story about the Iranian jetliner, that same thing happened with that, I can't remember, it was K something flight.
Korean.
The Korean flight that was shot down with Russia.
Right.
I mean, I was so mortified that that happened. And it seemed like it just kind of came and went.
Yeah.
And we lost, you know, there was government officials on that plane and whatever, but the story never really came out, as I recall. I don't bring that up as to put anything on your story, but it seems like the military just kind of under the rug.
You open a big box there by whether we talk about what the military can get away with or how they operate, you know, how we let them get away with and so on.
I have another observation about media. And you bring up Time magazine, bringing up the real question.
It was Newsweek.
Or Newsweek.
For a change. I mean,
either one.
They don't spend a lot of time on the real questions sometimes either.
The point is, it's still media. And so one media is obviously not being too real, and one media is maybe getting a little closer to the point. So where's the selective believing coming in? You know, here's a class about the images and media and what you have to be careful with, but this media was right this time.
Right. And that's what you can't rule out. I've been bad-mouthing big media most of the week. But if you watch them, keep your eyes open. There's some good things on them, obviously.
Sometimes, if you're selective, you can find that.
What I'd like to say from your comment and your comment is that tomorrow's session is called the sort of the Middle East witness side of it. What do we do about all this? And some of you won't be, not tomorrow, Saturdays. Some of you won't be here. If you're not going to be here Saturday and you'd like to talk in more about that, I'd be very happy to do it with you, and I'll give you an idea what it is. It's no big monster miraculous cure, but it goes in exactly these two directions. Join the frustrated questioners. They need help. Get out there and ask some of these questions through lobby groups, Middle East peace groups, church groups, peace groups, Middle East groups of any kind. That there are many several varieties we can look at. Become part of them. At least get their publications. The second one is balance your big media diet with some small media who specialize in the field. And the best example of that is this monthly right here, the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. It's not unbiased. It's, you could call it pro-Arab and anti-Israeli if you like. But in the mix of media and for the depths they go to find things out, which you don't get in a 30-second story on the evening news by any means, no matter how good they are, you've got to have something like this, because you're not an idiot. you can balance it with what else you know, and do that. They'd love you to. They allow quite a bit of debate right here in the, they encourage debate in the publication. But the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, put out by a group called the American Educational Trust, I believe, in Washington, comes out once a month. If you only could read one more thing, read this. And you'll find this kind of experience of thinking together about the Middle East. It goes on every month. It comes to your door. You can sit down and read it. And it'll help you also to look for the good stories in the big media. But if you want to talk about it, and you're not going to be here Saturday, come Saturday if you can, please, to talk about this in more detail. But if you're not, please come and see me, and I'll show you some of these things. There's also, in a more general sense, if some of you are from the ELCA, and that's who I can only speak for, and other major churches are doing this in a big way as well, the Presbyterians especially, the United Church of Christ, they all have mission programs, and part of their mission programs towards the Middle East is invariably these kinds of questions. The missionaries of the ELCA in the Middle East are tied down to the grassroots with this kind of question. These questions about how to deal more appropriately and more Christianly with the region. And here are some of the materials from the ELCA, in a general sense, relating to mission, that you can also have a look at. I was going to mention some stories, just as an example of what you don't find in the media very often. I've been at some of the ELCA's global mission events this summer, and Bishop Chilstrom, the leader of the church, has been there preaching on the opening night. And one of his lines was, if you think that you live in a Christian country, if you answer yes to the question, do I live in a Christian country, you got problems. Your mission is going to be severely warped and constricted if you say yes to that question. And that's a kind of a question to ask about the Middle East. You know, what is the relationship between the secular and the sacred, between religion and society? Well, how is that working out there? They have exactly the same dilemmas we do in terms of putting religion into their life, all of life, making it all of life, or separating it out into little boxes that trying to keep them apart. Don't let them get into one's business and one's religion, one's politics, one's religion, one's sport, one's religion, you know, those kind of things. That's a good sort of a story to read. And you'll find those kind of stories in some of these magazines. Another one is how. How are the Arabs handling all that wealth? You've got a few people making a killing off of the oil. And you've got millions of people who don't see a penny from it. What is that doing to their societies? What is that doing to the average Arab who's probably, by statistics, not going to be one of the ones who has oil running out of his pockets? You know, how often do we read that story? We read about the wealthy sheikhs, but we don't read about the little guy and what he thinks about the sheikhs, what he thinks about the sultans and the emirs and all those guys that we go to war for. What about, as Christians, the universal, common, ethical ground that exists between these three religions that all came from the same general culture and milieu? What is our common ethical ground that speaks to peace in the area between Jews, Muslims, and Christians? Is there enough between us that we agree about that we could be a force for peace together, not even as Christian peacemakers? We got, you know, here's one of your options, Middle East peacemakers. It's a nationwide ecumenical Christian grassroots membership movement, that follows all three pathways essential to peace in the Middle East, within the church, with peoples of other faiths, and among the nations. Christians with peoples of other faith, talking about peace. What is that as a topic for us in media to learn more about, if nothing else? Another question, has the U.S., are we part of the problem over there or part of the solution? Have we helped very much? We, the world's policemen, the greatest power on earth, you know. What have we done over there? Are we hindered justice or helped justice? What do they think of us? What do Middle Easterners think of us? You get a little bit of here in the video. It's an interesting thing to ask. Okay? I'll go probably a little quicker because I don't want to cut out that video or your questions. So I may just list a few things. If we live with stereotypes, if stereotypes keep coming back, they must be doing somebody some good, or else they wouldn't keep coming back. You and I don't like them, but how come they're always still there? One way to answer that is to say, who is served by it? And the first answer I would give about whose interests are served either directly or indirectly by that those stereotypes is ourselves. Our need for goods and bads, our insecurity vis-a-vis strangers and foreigners, other religions, our piety, our nostalgia for a simpler world or for a world that would be Christian and nice, or what we think we learned in our faith, something like that. You can keep those beliefs if you push the other guys away and say, they're different, they're bad, that's a strange religion, how come they're so like that, and we don't want to be like that, this kind of thing. Our guilt, since we vaguely know that we haven't perhaps been doing everything right over there, and we might have screwed up a few people, let alone killed a few people, by bombing them and cruise missiling them. So, surgically, these surgical strikes, how can you have a surgical strike, you know, with a weapon that can...
Especially if you completely unravel the economic stability.
Right. This kind of stuff, we have guilt about that, even if we support the war, that particular war, but we have guilt about it. It also serves our ignorance. When you've got bad images out there that explain the world for you, you don't have to learn anymore. You've got it all down, you know? So whose interest does it serve? It serves ourselves. There's a few others that are a little more concrete or a little more empirical, maybe. I mentioned the other day the travel business. They can sell you and me the idea of going to a place where we can see where Jesus walked, where the desert blooms, where our kind of people, namely the westernized part of the Israeli population, are doing wonderful things. The U.S. Israeli government is pretty happy, I think. Let me speak about whoever is holding power from a sort of a right-wing point of view in Israel is happy for these stereotypes to continue. The task of keeping us full of oil is served, I think, indirectly by these images, because we get to think of the region where that oil comes from as basically just sand and oil, you know? Desert Storm was a war in the desert, so that was okay, because it doesn't matter if you blow up the desert too much. And that oil's valuable. We got to keep that going to the free world. So let's not think about the rest of the region. Let's categorize it as a place of just those simple elements, camels, desert oil. And our TV pictures sort of proved it, didn't they? They all had some camels walking across among the sand and the oil. We were confirmed in what we thought about the place. And finally, as I said before, fundamentalists up here, fundamentalists and the fundamentalist in us is served by those images. We can't ask who is served without asking the twin question, who is victimized? And very, very briefly, because the answers start to lay over themselves and become the same, I would say the Arab masses are victimized because they don't even figure in the imagery. And they are the you and me's of that part of the world. And you and me don't figure in their imagery of us either, you know. They've got Bush up there as the equivalent of Saddam Hussein. To be more specific, in a part of the place where we're most concerned and most interested, the Palestinians as a people are victimized, although we've started to crack out of that a little bit because they are negotiating as a delegation. We've seen them speak for themselves, and by golly, you know, some of them are smart. And they know how to talk our language even and be smart in our language if you listen to Hanan Ashrawi. And even more specifically and limited, without ignoring the masses, the Arab Christians are victimized because they don't fit the mold. If our image is sand, oil, and Muslim fanatics, there's no room there for Arab Christians. Moderates, maybe, you know. People who have the same roots as us. There's another side to this victimization that comes into play with the Arab Christians, is that they link us. They are our way to break through all of this hype and all of this negative imagery, because they're Christians like like ourselves. They are our door to the Middle East, a door to the reality behind the stereotypes. But the problem is they're leaving. So if things go the way they're going for about 10 or 20 more years, in that one part of the world, especially Israel and the occupied territories, there aren't going to be very many Christians left to meet or to see the reality with when you get there. I said the first day that if you take all of this into consideration on the imagery side, one consequence is that we may never know the Arabs. And I think if you add these up, we demonize them, think they're fundamentalists, settle for fake stories about them, don't ask the real questions, let these guys get away with and ourselves get away with being served by all of this, and then miss a whole bunch of them out, how do we know the Arabs? There's not much left way to learn them, to meet them. But it happens again and again when you go there and when you see them as human beings face to face in a context, and you break through these many, many circles that separate us from them. Cultural prejudice, the bad news coverage, all those kinds of things. A couple words about the faith side here. But it may be better to let them talk for a minute before I do that. I don't want to cut that off by talking too much here. Any questions while I push this button? What you're going to see is a British production, just three slices from it. And I think it's interesting because it's a great documentary. If it was on TV, we'd probably all want to watch it. And I think it was on the BBC or two, 3 years ago. And why it's interesting is sort of this question about looking for the good things in otherwise questionable coverage of the region. At the beginning, it partakes of stereotypes. It gives us stereotypes that don't help us at all in our understanding. And when you watch it, you have to ask yourself, is this stereotyping so powerful that I'm not going to hear the rest of it? But there's good things that come then in the later part of the program. And for me, as a Christian in media work, the good things are so often the normal, regular people speaking from their hearts about the way their life is. And some of that comes through here. You're going to meet a young man who we would call a Muslim fundamentalist. And then you're going to meet another man who we'd also call that, and a woman who is an author and a commentator, and who calls herself a Muslim fundamentalist. So hear what they have to say. But listen first to the beginning. Then I'll do a little bit of fast forwarding. It was shown here in this country on WNET, I think.
By me?
Yeah.
Shake your faith in one God. So, who is for the mercy.
This is Terry Wayton, the hostage. The airliner. The music from Jaws. You know, the hostage as a stereotype image of a region is also something we haven't mentioned. And I'm going to go ahead. You can just watch the fast pictures. We know what happens. You know, the airliner pilot is in trouble, and people get taken off. Let me just, we basically have to finish, say that this will come tomorrow very nicely with the part about what do we do with all this, the difference between fundamentalism and faith. And in a word, what I would say is it's as much as possible, we need to think of it and think of our own faith as being the opposite of these kinds of things. The way we relate to other people without demonization, without strands of fundamentalism or rejecting those things, those building blocks within us, which are the same as the fundamentalists. Rejecting fake stories and fake questions. And knowing who is served and who is victimized by this stuff. So we'll get into that tomorrow. Are there questions or comments from people?
Up here.
Yes.
Her questions are well-founded, and a person who looks, I'll just say this, the 30 Years' War, maybe people know that or not, it was 1618 to 1648. The Catholics and the Protestants slaughtered each other in Germany. The founders of our nation, it was recognized at that time that state and politics, people in the slaughter for those people at that time, and they started moving the religion away from the government. And the people that formed our United States, they even wrote it into the Constitution, trying to prevent the slaughter didn't happen in their time, only a short period before.
Yeah.
So she raises questions that are that were dealt with in Christian history.
Right.
And our answer is not hypocritical, I don't think, or stupid. It was an attempt to stop slaughter.
Right, but may it not have gone too far? May we not have divorced them too far, where we abdicate the positive impact of religion?
Maybe
the Christian peace groups, the aspect of morality and dealing with other overseas people, especially.
Maybe we have, but it wasn't a senseless. It's not like we've taken a trip down a senseless path.
No. I hope I didn't suggest that, but it's sort of like we decided not to try to make religion responsible for all of life. And they're still trying to.
When, in my understanding of the Christian history, they tried to make it responsible for a lot, it resulted
in... It failed.
It failed.
Right.
And so they just...
But then the question is... Then the question is God still responsible for all life, and how does that inform our behavior and our actions? No matter what system we've cooked up, are we followers of our system or followers of God, you know? The question will never leave us. We haven't answered it. The Constitution was a brilliant document, but it didn't settle the problem. The Supreme Court spends, I think, 20% of its cases on that very same kind of question. Religion, separation of church and state.